So we're going to talk also about antibody drug conjugates. We've already talked about a bunch of them in this series. In breast cancer, we've known about T-DM1 for a long time. Now we have sacituzumab and triple negative disease and lymphomas. We've been using brentuximab vedotin. This is a question for the audience. Again, very new drug. Just kind of curious if anybody's seen a patient who's gotten enfortumab vedotin, an antibody drug conjugate for bladder cancer. And as we see whether or not anybody's seen any patient with that, Peter, can you talk a little bit about sort of what the kind of basic strategy is of these antibody drug conjugates? We see them now in gynecologic cancers, many other diseases.
Sure. I have to say, this is one of the more exciting developments that we've had in bladder cancer. It doesn't take long for an oncologist to figure out whether a drug has activity or whether it works for a disease. And this is one where it's pretty quick to tell that this drug is doing something for treatment of these patients. So antibody drug conjugate, as you mentioned, an example of what the molecule looks like is on the left of this slide. It's an antibody portion that is linked to actual cytotoxic molecules. The idea is that the antibody binds to a specific target. In this case, the target for this drug is a protein called Nectin-4. Turns out Nectin-4 is on the surface of basically all urothelial cancers. Almost every urothelial cancer will express Nectin-4 to some degree, which means, you know, I think importantly, unlike erdafitinib, which we just talked about, where you have to do, you know, a molecular test to see if your patient should even get erdafitinib, there's no test required for EV. All patients are eligible to get this in the post-platinum, post-immunotherapy space. So the antibody binds to Nectin-4, it internalizes the entire molecule, and then in lysosomes, the actual cytotoxic molecules are released, and they act like taxanes in a taxane-like fashion to disrupt microtubules and then disrupt cancer cell growth. So here's the efficacy data that we're showing. The drug had over a 40% overall response rate, impressive 12% complete response rate. If you look at that waterfall plot on the right, which, you know, every patient is a single bar on those waterfall plots, you can see the vast majority of patients, 84% of the patients, showed some degree of tumor reduction, which, remember, this was a highly refractory population. They had all been through multiple prior treatments, including platinum, including immunotherapy, and to see response rates like this was really almost unprecedented. It's, you know, activity like we'd expect of platinum-based therapy, cisplatin-based therapy in the front line, but we're seeing that in the third line space. So here's the actual FDA approval that happened in December of last year, approved for patients who previously received platinum and an immunotherapy.
So yeah, almost all those lines and then waterfall plot was going down. That's what we like to see. Arjun, what about tolerability issues with this particular agent? What's been seen?
One of the nice things about giving antibody drug conjugates is that, you know, by kind of hand delivering the toxic drug directly to the cancer cells, you know, the toxicities, you know, should be at least limited or very focused in nature. And I think that's what we're seeing with EV. The three main side effects are rash, neuropathy, and this syndrome of hyperglycemia. And I'll talk a little bit about hyperglycemia in a second because I think it requires a little bit of a focused discussion. But rash and neuropathy are the ones that really stand out, and they're really dose dependent. And patients will present with kind of a diffuse sunburn-like rash and some desquamation. And what I counsel patients on is you got to moisturize, 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 and avoid the sun, put a ton of SPF. If you're getting out in the sun, you know, be very careful about it. Some patients will have some itchiness of the skin, and much like we do with immunotherapy, with some antihistamines and sometimes topical corticosteroids, it actually can help with that part as well. But usually the rash is not anything that prevents treatment, you just have to manage it. Neuropathy, though, is something that's critically important. It is basically time and dose exposure dependent. The nature of the drug is that it's microtubule disrupting drug, and so neuropathy is common with those classes of agents. And usually what I've observed is about, you know, 4, maybe 5 months into treatment, patients will present with kind of this numbness and tingling in the hands and feet. And the numbness part really does concern me, especially when it involves the lower extremities, because then patients are walking flat-footed and they're really more careful. And all of a sudden you see them walking with a wide-based gait. And you have to be very careful about this, is because once it starts affecting their ADLs, grade one, grade two, I really dial back. And I think because, again, you can, by the time the neuropathy is bad, it's already too late, because you stop it and it's going to take months before it really gets better. So I think you have to be very careful about neuropathy. The hyperglycemia part is a little bit interesting, and many patients will develop these asymptomatic elevations in blood sugar. And we thought that, okay, well, listen, it's just hyperglycemia. You manage it with insulin and you know, diet modification and hypoglycemics and so forth. I think there's a benign version of hyperglycemia, but then there's this other thing that happens coincident with hyperglycemia, which is acidosis. So patients will present with renal dysfunction, really a big drop in their bicarb. And unfortunately, this is a metabolic acidosis syndrome that we really don't fully understand. Some of the more obese patients will get it. A baseline history of diabetes doesn't predict for this toxicity, by the way. So you can be a baseline diabetic and get this. You can be a completely fasting blood sugar and get this. And so this acidosis syndrome, unfortunately, I think we've had one or two fatal events because we don't fully understand it. It's just something that I would, when I counsel my patients, is that if that syndrome of acidosis is going to happen, it happens early in the course of treatment, generally within that first cycle. And so I really am careful about patients when they first start on treatment.
So when you hear this discussion of these two novel agents and the potential toxicities and the potential benefits, it's always kind of hard to sort of sort out what it really means in practice, Arjun. So if a patient's eligible for both erdafitinib and enfortumab vedotin, which one comes first?
I mean, I think you can go honestly either way. I don't think you can tease out the 40% objective response rate with, you know, erdafitinib and say, well, that's 44 with EV. I think you can honestly go either way. But a patient with baseline neuropathy, you might lead with erdafitinib, right? Because then you want to avoid and exacerbating an underlying condition. But the one thing that is convenient about EV is that it's intravenous, it's 30-minute infusion, the drug is in. Patients who have issues with taking pills, and they're on like 50 different medications, which we know many of our older individuals are, you're throwing another pill on top of that, and you're really worried about compliance, and then you got to dose titrate up, and you're really putting that in the patient's hand to manage that. EV, you know, when you're giving intravenous therapy, you've kind of taken that control away. Really, it's just to make sure that patients are compliant with drugs, really, so they don't have to worry about it so much.
So we're actually going to finish out with two cases of patients who got erdafitinib, and the second one particularly interesting. Let's start out with the 70-year-old patient, Susan. What happened there? Maybe just focus more on what happened when he got the enfortumab, but kind of what was his basic history?
So his basic history is that he had a really nasty upper tract tumor that didn't respond. Like, he basically developed metastatic disease within a month of his surgery and initially responded to pembrolizumab for a long time, had some time off of treatment. But when he did recur, he had this perirectal recurrence that became very rapidly progressive, painful. He couldn't pee without pain. He was on narcotics. He was also diabetic on insulin. And so when I first met him and we started him on enfortumab vedotin, I was like nervous. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's got a baseline rash. He's got baseline diabetes. He's got baseline elevated creatinine and LFTs. And so my teaching with him was, you have to really, you know, pay close attention to this. You know, tell us if your rash gets worse. I'm like worried that he's going to get cellulitis if he starts scratching at the rash that he already has. And also had to talk to the infusion room nurses because they weren't used to seeing this and had to, you know, basically they called me the one day. This is day 15. So the drug is given weekly, day one, day eight, day 15. And what they called me with is he said he's got a rash on his arms. And I said, okay, I have to see it. And so they could see his arms because he had shirt sleeves on. I said, well, take your shirt off. And this is what I saw. So, you know, he was basically not reporting because he is so afraid. Again, this is what I see so much, that we're not going to give him treatment. Quickly responded to stop, you know, I held the drug. The week off he had afterwards, when he came back for his next cycle, it had resolved. But because of the extent of this rash, we dose reduced him. And he's having a tremendous response. He hasn't had his follow-up scans yet, but he's off narcotics. His kidney function is actually better. So although he's diabetic, he did not get that diabetic ketoacidosis. He actually, things are getting better for him in so many ways. So I'm just praying that this lasts a long time. But he's been through such an amazing history. And then to be able to have this great response is just overwhelming.
Well, part of this amazing history that you see here, and as you mentioned in his course, was that he was on checkpoint inhibitor for 2 years, which is really amazing when you think about it. What was his condition?
He actually was off it for almost 2 years. So he was on it for like, you know, about almost a year, but then came off because he had such a great response to it and had developed some other complications. So he was off any treatment for 16 months when he developed this recurrence.
Amazing. Really interesting. We were talking about endocrine problems. This man had adrenal insufficiency that was thought to be related to checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah. It's while he was on the pembrolizumab, he developed a bad infection, ended up in the hospital with kind of a infection-related problem while he was in there that was diagnosed. I mean, he had definitely became adrenal insufficient. And so, you know, that's managed very well with hydrocortisone replacement.
Peter, any comments about adrenal insufficiency? Have you seen that in patients getting checkpoint inhibitors? Have you seen diabetes in patients getting checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah, those are both known potential toxicities. Both are relatively rare. And the problem is, you know, they don't necessarily respond to that idea of, you know, just blasting the patient with steroids like some of the other immune-related adverse events, like Susan was talking about for the adrenal insufficiency, you give replacement steroids. For diabetes, it can be difficult to manage, and you end up managing the patient like a type 1 diabetic.